Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. Later in this hour, a photo project that aims to stand stereotypes about Appalachian women on their heads. And we hear about Native American tropes and stereotypes in musical theater. First, the Trump administration's Office of Management and Budget is headed by Russell Vogt, who was an architect of the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025, which is something of a blueprint or a roadmap that the administration has been following from day one. Project 2025 recommends that political appointees and the president himself can exert direct control over scientific research grants to make sure they align with the president's policy priorities. There's a great deal of concern about this in the scientific and academic communities, and that's reflected in a recent commentary by Dr. Kumble Subbaswamy, published in the Kentucky Lantern. Dr. Subbaswamy is a former provost of the University of Kentucky, former chancellor of the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and is now a senior advisor to the nonprofit, nonpartisan organization Stand Together for Higher Ed. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Dr. Subbaswamy.
Thank you, Tom.
And first, another something you want to make clear about this.
Oh, yeah. I just want to make clear that I'm speaking as a private citizen and not as a part of any of the institutions that I have been associated with.
Okay. And you frame this as not a partisan issue. And in today's political climate, how can scientists, university leaders, and citizens, for that matter, make the case persuasively across ideological lines that this is nonpartisan?
Science itself is not a partisan matter because the principles by which science operates is that you start with following the evidence and forming hypotheses and putting them to test and having the entire world scrutinize it and then change your hypothesis if, in fact, the results warrant it. There's nothing political about that. I think where things get confusing is when a certain scientific finding leads to public policy decisions. That, of course, would be and could be political. Just as an example, the greenhouse effect is a scientific fact. Any Republican or Democrat or anybody anywhere in the world can go and do the experiments and convince themselves that, in fact, greenhouse gases result in a warming of the subsurface. But what do you do about it? You know, what steps do you take? Does this mean that you try to suppress all carbon dioxide emissions through policy? Or do you, in balancing economic impact, immediate economic impact versus the long-term effect, you come to a different conclusion? Those are political decisions. But when politicians and even others simply conflate the two and say global warming is a hoax, they're doing a disservice because that's not the hoax. The hoax may be how quickly, you know, we get into a situation where really it becomes intolerable, and that's debatable and so on. So I really want to make clear that all of the scientific research that's being funded by the federal government and so forth, the science itself is not political. And yes, you know, people can draw conclusions from it and go towards policy decisions that certainly are in the political domain.
So tell us more about this proposed change in how federal science grants are awarded.
Sure. First of all, the proposed changes are extensive and they run some 400 pages, but I think some of them are in the weeds. But the most significant and overarching change that is of concern is that the final decision on what grants are funded is now given to the political appointees rather than what has been the case for the last 80 years in scientific research funding in the country, which is to have the experts, scientists, peers themselves decide on what directions are worth funding and what scientific research is worth funding. I think this is a really troublesome issue for the country because, you know, science ultimately leads to technology. And so the decision on what is most promising should be made by scientists themselves, as has been the case, rather than by politicians.
I think that at the heart of your argument is the difference between scientific peer review and political review. What does peer review protect that political review might endanger?
Sure. The way things work currently, and they should, in my opinion, is that when people submit research projects for funding. It's really studied and rated and evaluated by people who are experts in the field, and then they make a recommendation as to funding it or not. And then there are career scientists in the government who then align it with availability of funds and even priorities sometimes, which are themselves set by scientific panels that are put together by either the president or respective secretaries in the cabinets and so on. So the decisions really are made by experts who know what this is all about. I think the political decision-making can really then lead to not the best science being funded. In fact, some science being suppressed. Just as an example, you know, environmental research, I gave you an example. The research itself is important because we need to know what impact our, you know, carbon emission has and how it can be mitigated and so on. But then what you do with it is really where the policy comes in. And it would be a real shame if this important line of research were suppressed or not funded because the government doesn't want to see this research done.
The proposal says federal awards should advance the president's policy priorities, as we've said. Now, some might hear that and ask, but isn't it reasonable for elected leaders to set priorities for how public money is spent? What would be your response to that?
Sure. I mean, I think the priorities are set by the government in how much budget is allocated for, say, organizations like National Science Foundation, National Institutes of Health. And sometimes, in fact, there is even, you know, congressional mandates focusing on particular areas, maybe breast cancer as an example, for instance. So no one is arguing about that. Really, the argument here is that once those budget parameters and priorities are set, how the research funding for each individual projects is determined, you know, which ones are funded and which ones are not funded, should be solely determined by which have the best chances of advancing knowledge and ultimately advancing technology rather than some sort of a ideology. I mean, you know, I think, again, you know, climate change would be one example of where ideologically the government may not like to talk about man-made climate change, but that should not be the final decision-making mechanism. It should be really what's good science. That's where I think that it's important that experts themselves who really understand the science are the ones who are making the final decision.
Well, in your commentary, you warn that research funding tied too closely to political priorities could discourage certain questions from being asked. What kinds of research are most vulnerable when scientists begin to anticipate political approval or disapproval?
I think we already have seen that anything pertaining to the environment is something that is subject to censorship even, because some of the government agencies like the Environmental Protection Agency have been told not to use certain words, not to advance certain hypotheses and so on. And the publication itself is being limited in terms of what the government says about the environment. That's, you know, one example. But also there are examples how different medicines really work in different people of different racial composition or gender composition and so on. And so if you start saying that certain words and certain types of research are not to be done at all, whether in pertaining to, for example, the difference between how a medical intervention may work for men versus women or for African-Americans versus Caucasians and so on, then you're really interfering with our ability to treat society as it is. And so those are really issues that I think should not be subject to political considerations, and they should really be left up to the scientists to determine what is valid science and what is important science as well.
There is concern about keyword screening, proposals that could be flagged for words like diversity, even when the term has a scientific meaning, not the one the government uses. For example, scientists may study genetic diversity in crop species. They're trying to improve drought resistance. Or maybe in pharmaceutical research, chemical diversity, referring to the range of different molecular structures. What do these examples reveal about the limits of political or automated, which I think is what is a huge concern here, automated review of research?
Yeah, I mean, I think that automated reviews, as we have seen, will lead to silly results and does great disservice to society because we do need to understand, for example, the impact of different types of diverse bacteria or diverse immune systems and so on. So the word diversity itself is used in different contexts, but if you just sort of make that a flag and say anything that pertains to diversity is not to be funded, I mean, that really is hurting society a great deal by curtailing really important directions of research.
You invoke the history of Soviet biology under Trofim Lysenko as a cautionary example. What's the lesson there?
Again, the lesson there is let scientists decide on the science and not politics. Because if you say that any science that's done in science hypotheses have to agree with a certain political philosophy, you don't get science. It's no longer science. And in the case of Soviet science, genetic research was really curtailed and had to conform to political philosophy. And that really led to droughts and other really terrible consequences. So you really do not want that kind of a science to have to cling to some kind of a political philosophy.
You also point to something that I think is a great example of how disruptive to the scientific process this could be, and that is the long-running research at UK's Sanders Brown Center on Aging. Why is research that's built over decades, such as that, with volunteers and accumulated data, especially vulnerable to abrupt changes in these funding priorities?
Indeed, research that involves longitudinal studies studied over periods of time depend on the continuity. And so if every time there's a change in government or change in government policy, that research was interrupted, humanity really loses a great deal of value that comes from those longitudinal studies. And, aging is a very important aspect of it. And so, yes, I think that we really need to worry about the continuity of those kinds of a long arc research projects.
UK received more than half of its fiscal 25 external research awards from federal grants and contracts. Does that level of dependence on federal funding leave the university openly exposed to any political manipulation of federal funding?
I think that as long as the federal government policies are set to really advance the science and advance knowledge, it's really not dependent on those policies or who's making those policies. It should not be really dependent on party either. But if, in fact, those policies are affected by political preferences, then indeed the objectivity of science is impacted, and I think the citizens suffer as a result of that kind of a bias in what is acceptable research and what is not acceptable research.
Well, there's also a global competitiveness argument in your commentary that nations leading in science tend to lead in industry, in defense, in future jobs. How do you assess the risk that political filtering of research could weaken the U.S. long-term position?
I think that we have seen, the impact of political interference in advancing science in other countries, in the Soviet Union and so forth. So we really do know that the policy making depending on the science is indeed in the hands of politicians, but the science itself should not be influenced by politicians or politics of the moment.
When you ask Kentuckians to speak out, what are you asking them to defend? Universities, science, medical progress, economic development, democratic self-government, or all of the above?
In some sense, it's really all of the above. I think that objectivity in science is important. And so I think political preferences should not dictate the direction of science, results that are then accepted into policy.
All right. That's former University of Kentucky Provost Dr. Kumble Subbaswamy, now senior advisor to the nonprofit, nonpartisan organization Stand Together for Higher Ed. His commentary was published by the Kentucky Lantern on June 10th. You can find it on their website. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard. If you just joined us, earlier in the hour, we heard from former UK Provost Kumbhle Subbaswamy raising concerns about a White House plan to hand over to political appointees the vetting of federal scientific research grants. If you missed it and want to listen, you can find the segment on our homepage at esweku.org. Often when we feature the arts on Eastern Standard, it's in partnership with UndermainArts.org. It's a nonprofit online arts magazine where I serve as senior editor. We have two of those collaborations in this week's edition. The first of the two was inspired when Letcher County-based photojournalist Malcolm Wilson came across negative portrayals of Appalachian women in social media. An idea was born to counter the all-too-familiar narrative with a photo project titled Appalachian Beautiful. And as you'll hear, it turns out that Malcolm wasn't the only one who was rubbed the wrong way by those portrayals of the women of the mountains. The exhibit opened at the Appalachian Artisan Center in Hindman on May 30th and runs through the end of July. Malcolm and two of the women who answered his call to be photographed for the project, Arletta Adams and Amber Ellswick, are with us here in the studio. Thank you all for making the trek up to Lexington today.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And so, Malcolm, let's start with you. Tell us about this project.
Well, after watching a tremendous amount of these influencers, which I call uninfluencers, and how they were portraying Appalachian women as barefoot and ignorant and all that, I knew the women in my life, and they weren't anything like the women being portrayed by these uninfluencers. From my grandmothers to my mother who fought breast cancer for 20 years, and it finally beat her, the strongest woman I've ever known. My sister, who's director of the Appalachian Boys and Girls Clubs, is turning the way we teach children in Appalachia upside down, and two wonderful daughters who are just brilliant. And I'm thinking about all that swirling around my head, and at the same time, I remembered seeing a photo exhibit. I lived in Cincinnati for a while, left Eastern Kentucky to go to Northern Kentucky University, and ended up staying up there 18 years. Normally, I wouldn't have stayed that long, but I found a community of displaced Appalachians living in Cincinnati, so I found my people there, and it made my life there easier. But during that tenure, there was an exhibit at the Cincinnati Art Museum of George Harrell. George Harrell was born in Cincinnati right around the turn of the 20th century. He lived in Cincinnati, then moved to Northern Kentucky, from what I understand, for a short period of time, then left and went to Hollywood to make a career as a painter. Once he got to Hollywood, he found out he wasn't as good a painter as he thought he was, and he had a camera he'd been using to make photographs of his paintings, I guess, and one thing led to another, and he photographed somebody fairly famous in Hollywood at the time, and then they showed it to somebody else, and it just blossomed, and he became the most influential photographer in Hollywood from the 20s through the 1950s, shooting starlets and stars. And he had a specific way he did it, and it was unique, and he had to use what they used to call back in the day hot lights, which were big old, the only lighting he could get a hold of was what he could buy from surplus auctions at Hollywood studios and use these lights. And he made these photographs, and not only made these photographs, but he retouched them. Most people say, oh, that's been Photoshopped. Well, retouching has been around a long time before Photoshop. At first, George and he had a retoucher working for him that actually retouched the photographs using graphite pencils. Back then, everything was black and white, so you used graphite pencils to retouch on the actual negatives. Now, these negatives were big, 4x5, 5x7, and 8x10 negatives, so it was easy to draw on them. And he would bring these starlets in without any makeup on, photograph them, and then the retouchers would retouch them and smooth their skin and do all that. Then in 1946, a guy by the name, I believe his name was Henry Adams, invented the Adams retouching machine, which is a machine that made it even easier to retouch photographs. And basically what that machine did was you put the negative in there and it vibrated it. So it let those pencil marks blend better so they were not as easily discernible as being retouched. In fact, in the 70s, when I lived in Cumberland, Kentucky, in Harlan County, our photographer at the time, he had a portrait studio. I purchased all of his old equipment at a reduced rate, and in that equipment was an Adams retouching machine. And he taught me how to use that machine. And you have to have a steady hand. Now, at my age now, I could not do that. But I did learn how to use and retouch photographs. So what I did was embrace the way that George Shirreal photographed these women and retouched them. And I thought in my mind, would it not be great if Appalachian women could be transported back in time to George Shirreal's studio and be photographed? Well, that's impossible. So the only way to do it is for me to do it in my little studio in Blackie, Kentucky, in Letcher County. And me and an intern of mine talked about it. Her name is Delatis Haywood, incredible young lady. And she and I talked about it, and we devised a plan to launch. At first, we called it the Appalachian Starlet Project. Then, as it started blossoming, we thought maybe we'd get like a little 12, 14-print exhibit out of the thing, you know, and it'd die. Even had artist friends said, you're not going to have many people turn out and get involved in that. I'm talking about really close artist friends. And they were as shocked as I was that we had a massive amount. We ended up shooting 62 photographs for what I call phase one. Wow. There will be a phase two because there are so many more that want to be part of this project and believe in this project. So we started doing it, and we learned along the way. I used a lot of the techniques that George Shirreal used. I used what's called constant lighting instead of studio strobes, which is the LED version of what he used. And I retouched them using modern technology, but within the limitations that George could do with what he had. There are ways with technology now to expand even further what was available. So I like to call the work in the tradition of while standing apart from George Shirreal. He's with me every time I photograph one of these wonderful Appalachian women. He's sitting on my shoulder. So that's how the project developed. And it has just become this, it has a life of its own. It's in all my years of making photographs, this is the biggest project I've ever done in my career.
Well, we're on the radio, and I'm betting that you're making that listener want to see these.
Yes.
And they can. You can go to undermainarts.org. That's our partner arts website, and you will find this story on that site with the photographs. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. The opening for the exhibit was at the Artisan Center in Hindman. It was a red carpet rollout and also involved something called, you called it a barefoot protest.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
I wanted to carry this whole idea of these ladies being starlets from start to finish. So some of the ladies started calling it the Appalachian Met Gala. Okay. So we had a red carpet and all these women dressed in just luxurious gowns and... And by the way, we broke the record in 27 years of the Artisan Center of how many people attended an opening at the Artisan Center. But these women have become my friends, and they trust me in a lot of things that they probably wouldn't trust most men in, like which dress should I wear and what shoes should I wear and things like that. We developed this bond that is absolutely amazing. But in the conversation, we have a chat group. that all the women are in, both those that have been photographed and those waiting in the wings to be photographed. And one night, the ladies were talking about what kind of shoes they were going to wear. And one said, well, those kind of shoes hurt my feet. I'm just going to wear my sneakers. And another lady chimed in and said, why don't we go barefoot? Why don't we throw back in their face what they think that we're barefoot and ignorant in Appalachia? And let's throw that back in their face and let's do a barefoot protest. So immediately I said, this is brilliant. I couldn't think of anything better. And it didn't come from me. It came from one of the ladies. And those ladies are as much a part of this team as I am. And I credit them for the art as much as me. They're as artists as much as I am. But what we ended up doing, well, I put on the chat group, I said, okay, ladies, I'm for this. And I told them, I said, if at least 10 of you promise to do this barefoot protest, I'll have a pedicure and have my nails painted. Well, one of the women chimed in and said, if 10 of you do it and he does it, I'm going to pay for his pedicure. So we had 18 on the chat group immediately said, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. I'm going to do it. By the time the opening happened, we had a lot more than that. So basically what we did was after everybody had some food and walked around and looked at the exhibit, I took all the ladies outside to the red carpet. We took our shoes off. We had an amazing fiddle player there, probably one of the best fiddle players to come out of Eastern Kentucky in many, many years. His name is Ishi Wooten. Ishi went inside with his fiddle, and he played as we all marched into the gallery barefoot. And not only was it me and the women, but there are a lot of men that join in. I had one professor from UK that's a friend of mine that came to visit down there. He stripped his shoes off, and other guys stripped their shoes off, and we all walked into the gallery, and then we started sort of an official or unofficial program talking about the project and letting the women speak about the project and that kind of thing.
And we have a photograph of Malcolm baring his feet, complete with a pedicure, on the website, so you'll be able to see that there. Amber and Arletta, I'd like to know what moved each of you to get involved in Malcolm's project. And Arletta, let's start with you. You've written an essay about the project. It's available, along with Malcolm's photographs and an essay by Amber, on the site of our partner, undermainarts.org. And in your essay, you say, and I'm quoting you here, some people will look at these portraits and think it's about glamour. And sure, there's beauty in them. But that's not the point. The point is dignity. The point is control of the narrative. The point is saying you don't get to tell our story for us anymore. So tell us more about that, Arletta.
I think what I mean, you know, whenever I say that it's about dignity, I feel like that everybody deserves to be seen, you know, like as a complete human being. You know, these portraits don't cover up hardship, and they're not pretending, you know, that our struggles don't exist. It shows, you know, that our people or more than the worst assumptions that people, you know, have made about us. I feel like this project, you know, flips that dynamic. It's not the outsiders documenting us, you know, it's our community coming together, and we get to decide, you know, what the stories are that we want to tell.
It's kind of a way that Appalachia has never shown itself before, isn't it?
Yes.
Amber, after Malcolm put out the call for models, you responded, and in your reply, which in my book is an essay, you said that you learned early that when people hear that you're from Appalachia, they think they already know you and know who you are. Tell us more about that.
Because there's such a great stigma around what Appalachian people are, people assume we're ignorant and poor and uneducated, and literally, when I said, when they hear you're from Appalachia, all they have to do is hear my voice because I have such a thick accent. But I'm over the stigma, like Arletta said. I don't want other people to tell our stories. I want us to tell our own stories. I want people to know who we truly are as Appalachian people.
What do each of you hope that people take away after they viewed the photographs and read your essays? And let's start with you, Amber.
Appalachian Beautiful, it's not just about the beauty. It's not just about a pretty face. It's about our stories and our dignity and our pride and who we are as people. And I want people to know that we're not uneducated. We are doctors and lawyers, and we have a radiologist in one of the photos. Like, we are educated women. We are strong, we are powerful, and we are prideful.
You know that people are going to go to the website and see the photographs and read the essays. And after they've done all that, is there something that you hope that they remember about it that's really important to you? Arletta?
I hope they see this project and they see us through a lens of pride rather than pity. You know, we're not asking for approval. We're simply showing the world our strength and our resilience, our creativity, our beauty. Like, we're not trying to make Appalachia beautiful. Appalachia's always been beautiful. We just want to push back on the stereotypes that are not true to us. And I hope that people look at this project and hear us for the first time. I feel like we've been seen through other people's eyes and other people's opinions. So I hope this changes that some.
So, Malcolm, where does Appalachian Beautiful go from here?
Phase two, where we're going to allow other people to be photographed for the project. We eventually want to get it to the point where there's two or more exhibits that can be shown simultaneously. So there may be an exhibit in Lexington. There may be an exhibit in Cincinnati. There may be an exhibit in Pikeville. And we're not going to have a problem finding subjects and people want to get involved. Right now, the project has women from four states. That's the first 62 women. And I don't know how many counties, 20-some counties. So I expect it to blossom and blossom, and we're going to get the word out. And then me and one of the ladies involved in it, she's going to edit a book, and I'm hoping these two lovely writer ladies that are joining with me today, Arletta and Amber, will help us write that book because they are amazing with the written word. So hopefully we'll get a book. I would like to say this, if there are any galleries out there that are listening to this or have connections to galleries, get in contact with me. Easiest way to find me is on Facebook, Malcolm J. Wilson.
Well, listener, you can take a deep dive into everything we've been talking about here, into the Appalachian Beautiful Project, the essays from Arletta and Amber, the photographs, and also a song that was composed and recorded to support this. It's all there. And again, that's Under Main, like Under Main Street, undermainarts.org. Arletta, Amber, Malcolm, thank you so much for joining us here on Eastern Standard.
Thanks for having us.
Tom, thank you so very much.
Our arts partner, undermainarts.org, just launched a new series with a grant from the Kentucky Native American Heritage Commission. The Art of the Originals explores indigenous art in the 21st century, and it begins with a look at Native American tropes and stereotypes in American musical theater. The article was researched and written by Trevor McChristian, an enrolled citizen of the Navajo Nation, who has performed in Lexington Theater Company productions of The Music Man, A Chorus Line, and West Side Story. He appeared on Eastern Standard back in March to talk about the land acknowledgement in a growing number of theater playbills, paying respect to the indigenous peoples who occupied lands that have since become places where theaters are located. Trevor, welcome back to Eastern Standard.
Thank you so much, and glad to be back here.
Your article begins with the idea that American musical theater has helped shape the country's cultural imagination. And when it comes to Native Americans, what has musical theater taught audiences, often without audiences even realizing they're being taught something?
Yes. Well, I think musical theater and just the arts in general is a really great avenue to influence culture as a whole. And we've seen it since the beginning of time, right? Theater is influential. And I think when it comes to musical theater, especially the sort of larger scale Broadway elements of things, the opportunities that Native Americans get on stage are few and far between. Thinking of things right off the top of your head, what's a musical that has a Native American character? There's very few that you can kind of think of immediately. You think of maybe Peter Pan or possibly something like Annie Gets Your Gun.
Like the Chippewa, Iroquois, Omaha, like those Indians, I'm an Indian too, a Sioux.
Oftentimes, those specific Native characters are capitalized on tropes and stereotypes that kind of persist throughout culture as a whole. It's not just musical theater, right? And so I think the sort of stories that we're telling and the influence that theater or musical theater has in terms of presenting Native ideologies or depictions of Native people, whether that be historically or in modern times, is very clear because most people that come to the theater aren't engaging one-on-one with Native communities or maybe even Native people, right? We don't make up a huge portion of the population, although millions of us are still here and continue to persist in all industries. So I think when people come and see maybe these tropes or these bigger characters that maybe lean a little bit too much into stereotypes, I think that that's influencing your perception of Native people as a whole. Well, this is what I'm seeing, so this is what Native people must be. And that's been happening for decades now.
Let's talk about Peter Pan, because it's such a familiar and a beloved work for a lot of people. What do the Native characters and songs in older versions of Peter Pan reveal about the way Native identity was turned into theatrical fantasy?
So it's interesting because there have been many iterations of Peter Pan that have existed. So the original back in the 50s has been, how do I say this? Maybe not the best. Let's just say it's a bit offensive, right? There's elements here where you kind of see Native song and dance depicted in maybe a nonsensible way. Tropes and stereotypes where language is lots of grunting, oftentimes maybe even caveman-esque. I mean, there's elements within many different Native languages that have maybe not your typical sounds or phonetics like would happen in English, but that doesn't necessarily equate to sort of a caveman-esque language like what we see in the original production of Peter Pan. Additionally, I think that the only real sort of main character, if you even want to call her that, in Peter Pan that is Native is Tiger Lily. And she is a supporting character, doesn't have a whole lot of depth to her in the original. Additionally, I think the ways that Peter Pan and Tiger Lily are portrayed on stage, with Tiger Lily, she has a lot of dance movement that is, again, a little stereotypical, a little too tropey when it comes to depicting a real life version of a Native or Indigenous person. Thinking about in that original 50s production, there were no Natives in the cast. Tiger Lily wasn't played by an Indigenous woman. And so it's a lot of capitalizing on maybe other people's perception or the actor's current perception of what they think Native people are or how they think Native people act.
Well, some might be listening to us and they might wonder, well, isn't this just a product of its time?
Many people would look at it through a historical lens. That was a sign of the times. Yes, but culture is constantly evolving, where if we have these beloved stories and these beloved characters that we want to see and we want to share and relive in those worlds, why wouldn't we update it for a little bit more of a modern lens? I don't think that that takes away any of the heart of the show in any capacity. I actually think that it makes it better. I think it expands these worlds. It opens people's minds to some greater representation of Indigenous people as a whole. So I think the best way to do that is to employ Native people, whether that be Native writers, Native composers, Native directors, Native consultants even, to shape what these worlds could look like with true Indigenous influence.
Now, you also discuss Annie Get Your Gun and the broader mythology of the quote-unquote Wild West. How did musical theater help romanticize frontier expansion while it left out the experiences of Indigenous communities that were being expanded upon?
Yes, this is really tricky, right? Because when you're writing a musical or you're writing a show, you want to lean into the fantasy of it all. You want to create this world of escapism for a lot of people. At least that's kind of what musicals were originally sort of designed and sculpted to do. But that does take away a lot of the reality of the situations that these characters or these people were going through. I talk about in my article a little bit about Oklahoma, the musical, where although it's super beloved and I really like Oklahoma, I've done multiple productions of it, I've played multiple characters. I think it's a classic in all of the best ways. However, the reality of Oklahoma is at the time, there was Indian removal that was happening. The Enabling Act of 1906, I believe, was essentially expanding Western territory into this sort of like frontier land, if you will. And Oklahoma doesn't actually talk about any sort of horrors or injustices that Native people were facing when it comes to the expansion westward. Manifest destiny is a very large concept that we all learn about in school, right? We learn that it's good in history. We want to explore. We're modern explorers in terms of the colonization of America. That's what we've been told. But when it comes to the reality of what was truly going on at that time, I think we have to look a little bit deeper and we have to look with a much closer lens to see the influence that it was having on Native people that have been here for centuries before any sort of westward expansion.
You've touched a couple of times on where we are now, are kind of a turning point in the trajectory of Native American representation in theater. And you point to the 2014 NBC Peter Pan and the later national tour with a new book by Larissa Fasthorse. What changed when Native artists were brought into the creative process?
Quite literally, lyrics changed, words changed, movement changed, connection changed. I think there's so many different elements about having a Native person in the room. Just speaking from my own personal experience, so I've recently been working on a new musical without giving too much away because it's still very under wraps. And I have been working professionally as an actor since I was 14 years old. I've been working unprofessionally as an actor since I was about 4 years old. So I've got plenty of experience in these spaces, but something about this one, which is it's a half Native cast and we're telling sort of a retelling in a lot of ways of the Battle of Greasy Grass, aka the Battle of Little Bighorn, which happened in the Black Hills. And we're learning a lot of this music, which again has a Native composer and a white composer, as well as a Native writer and a white writer. We're constantly in between these two worlds, but we're actively in the rehearsal space sort of decolonizing theater and the ways that it's made as it happens, which I think some people will hear that and go, oh, that's a little scary. I don't know about all that, decolonizing in a lot of ways. But it's important to note that decolonizing is less about everything sort of changing, and it's more about warping your perception to understand sort of true ecological knowledge from Indigenous perspectives. We're learning music in a circle. We're listening to one another. We're laughing. We're enjoying. It's less rigid. It's less buttoned up. It's less to the point and to the book and getting everything done, dotting your I's and crossing your T's in all of these ways, because it's about community. It's community-based, and that's the best part.
Toward the end of the article, you highlight Native playwrights and theater makers, including Madeline Easley, Madeline Sayette, Tara Moses, Rihanna Yazzie. What do these artists show us about the range and richness of contemporary indigenous storytelling.
Yes, of course. Well, thanks for giving them a shout out. I really appreciate it. So those are just four writers. And we, of course, have talked about Larissa Fast Horse as well. There are a myriad of Native voices that are being produced or that are currently writing or that deserve to be heard and put on the stage. In America, there's 576 federally recognized tribes, right? And of all of the writers that you have just mentioned, none of them are in the same tribe. They all come with their own unique perspectives, their own lived truth and identity. Although the Native theater space is relatively tight-knit, and we do kind of all know each other in some ways, I'm constantly learning from all of them about different tribal elements that they bring to the table, something about burning different types of medicine that maybe is not sacred medicine in the Navajo Nation, but is in the Cherokee Nation, or things like that, where we're constantly learning from one another because everybody here has such unique perspectives and brings something special to the table here that I think needs to be heard, regardless of, let's put it this way. Go look historically at all of the fantastic white playwrights that have existed throughout the history of time. There's tons of them. We love them, right? Now think historically about all of the Native playwrights that are on the same level. Crickets? Okay, great. That's what I thought, right? But I think we're at this time where there's so many of them. They are continuing to write such great work. And we are at a precipice of an evolution here where you're going to be seeing and hearing from a lot more Native voices and Native perspectives very, very soon.
Well, for theaters that want to do better, Broadway, regional theaters, universities, community theaters, what practical steps, Trevor, would move the field beyond consultation or symbolic inclusion toward genuine partnership?
Wow, that is a loaded question. In the best way, though, because there's so many different things. I mean, I think about it this way, where we're not trying to change the world, right? We're just trying to influence each other's perspectives. We're trying to share what I know, share what you know, and come together to collaborate and work collectively, especially when it's community-based. I think if you're able to move the needle just to the left a little bit of what exactly we're trying to accomplish here, or one person from a different perspective learns something from you, and then they bring that forward into another room, and then they affect other people in that room, it's more of a tangled web that we want to influence here as to how we truly affect change in the ways that theater is made, theater is produced, the ways that we communicate with each other in and outside of the space, and the ways that it really is about what community means, because most of us got into theater in the first place, not because we were amazing at it at age six or whatever. We got into it because we really liked it. We had fun. I like singing. I like to be on stage. I like hanging with my friends and sharing that common interest. And I think coming back to the root of why I started to do theater in the first place is what makes Native theater so special. We tell those stories, and we tell those stories together with one another to all come to sort of the common ground that weaves us all together.
Well, I'm curious, what is your personal take on this? How have these tropes and stereotypes affected you?
Like I said, I've been working professionally since I was 14, so I've encountered a lot of stuff, a lot of different types of people, a lot of different things. But I think one of the biggest sort of shocks that I found was throughout my auditioning in New York City, there were rarely ever a Native role that came across the table. There was very rarely. I was constantly going in for these shows or bigger things that weren't Native specific, which was perfectly fine by me. But I was told directly, my agents were have been shared information that I went into an audition room at one point in time, and I walked away with the feedback that I was, quote, too brown to be in the show, which is something that I had never been told before. I also think it's important to note that I'm mixed. I have a white mother and I've got a Native father. And so for me to hear that sort of feedback was confusing because I am both. And then I think, well, do I need to stay out of the sun? Like, will I be able to be in this show if I'm a little bit lighter skinned? It's just a weird sort of dysmorphia that it sort of causes in your brain. And I know that my experience is not singular. I know that there are plenty of actors or creatives that have experienced something exactly like I have. It's less about what I bring to the table and more about sort of a lack of opportunity, unfortunately. But again, I think that that's changing. I think that that's shifting, and the world is shifting in hopefully a positive direction towards a little bit more inclusivity that way.
Well, you end the article by asking when modern theater will catch up to the timeless ways of indigenous storytelling. What would that look like, in your view, for American theater to actually finally catch up with that style of storytelling?
Yeah, well, the industry of theater, it's a money-making business, just like everything else in the world, right? So we got to make some money around this. But I think rooting it in sort of capitalism or rooting it in turning a profit is what Native creatives are kind of fighting against. Yes, we want to make a profit. Yes, we want to be successful. Yes, we want our shows to be seen and heard. But I think what makes those shows great, or what makes those shows be seen or heard, is good material, is good writing, is good performances. And I think what I'm in and what I have been doing the past several years in terms of the Native theater scene, there's a lot of good work, and there are a lot of great creatives, writers, directors, producers, actors that are bringing that to the table. And so I think when you sort of expand your mind to think about the art that you are creating and rooting it again in community, in traditional sort of ecological knowledge, tying it back to how we're connected to the land, we're connected to this space, how all of us as human beings are connected to each other, regardless of race or gender or religion or class or anything, right? It's important that we root ourselves and root the theater that we are making in that traditional indigenous knowledge.
Trevor McChristian, author of Native Americans in American Musical Theater, Stereotypes, Representation, and the Struggle for Opportunity. It's the first in the series, The Art of the Originals. And you'll find Trevor's article on our partner website, undermainarts.org. Thank you so much, Trevor.
Of course, thank you again.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced by WEKU and Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer. Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director. Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're on the WEKU, Apple, Spotify, and NPR apps, and you can stream all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our contributors and their interview archives. Send thoughts and suggestions to es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard.